This episode of UMES 30 contains language some listeners may find offensive.
Wake up! Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. You are now listening to UMES 30. I'm your host, Dr. Joshua K. Wright. I realize that you could be anywhere in the world right now, but you're here listening to me, and I sincerely appreciate that. UMES 30 is a new talk show airing on Sunday mornings. I'll be bringing you lively, thought-provoking discussion on a variety of topics. Each show will feature an extended conversation with a guest. While many of these individuals will come from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and the local community, I will also feature several guests from around the country. Please note that the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of 91.3 WESM or the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.
Earl Lloyd, we all know that it was far too long for basketball to open their arms to African Americans. Weren't we fortunate? Wasn't our sport fortunate that when we did, we chose a man who was a leader, a team player, and such a class act. And so tonight, you go where you've earned into this Hall of Fame honors ring. By vote of the Honors Committee and by the power vested in the Board of Trustees, I am privileged to be able to induct you as a player into the Naismith Memorial Basketball Fame with all rights and privileges. Congratulations.
Since February is Black History Month, today's show will feature excerpts from a recent interview I did with Kevin Lloyd, the son of the late Earl Lloyd. Earl Lloyd was a sports trailblazer who was inducted into the Naismith Hall of Fame for basketball in 2003. He was also drafted as a pitcher by the Pittsburgh Pirates in 1950. However, he never played in the major leagues. Mr. Lloyd was born in Alexandria, Virginia in 1928. And he died in 2015. His son, Kevin, was kind enough to conduct an hour-long interview with me this past January. Today, you'll be hearing some excerpts from our conversation. I hope you enjoy.
So, your father is a trailblazer. Now, I'm a sports fan, and I work with a lot of young people, and most of them, the furthest they know in terms of basketball history is maybe Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Magic Johnson, Dr. J. They don't go too far.
Way before them.
Yeah. Well, you know, my students are young. You know, they're millennials and whatever. You know, whatever comes after millennials, they're pretty young. So, but your father, you know, again, he was a trailblazer, and I really want to stress this because, you know, I know a lot of people may not be familiar with the name Earl Lloyd, but Earl Lloyd was basically the Jackie Robinson of professional basketball, of the NBA.
No, don't use the word basically. He was the Jackie.
He was, okay.
Jackie, he was the Jackie talking basketball.
Okay, right.
And a lot of folks compare my father as Earl Lloyd, the Jackie Robinson of basketball.
Okay. So you tell the story, because I don't want to get it wrong. So your father was the first African-American to play in the NBA in 1950, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
October 31st, 1950.
Okay. So.
But they had two other guys, Seth Cooper and Sweetwater Clinton.
Okay.
And one was the first drafted, another one was the first one to sign.
Okay.
But my father, by day, was the first one to play.
Okay.
It was just in the schedule.
Okay. So let's make sure we have this correct. So who signed first? Was that Sweetwater?
I think Sweetwater put the sign first for the Boston Celtics.
Okay. But your father was the first one who actually played in a game, though.
He was the first one to step on the court, yes, correct.
Okay. And for what team?
The Washington Capitals.
Well, okay. So that would be the Wizards today, right?
But the Wizards today.
Right. Remember, the Capitals back then. Okay. So I want to know, like, because, you know, when we hear the Jackie Robinson story, we hear about Branch Rickey, we hear about the black sports journalist who, you know, was active in getting Branch Rickey to bring up black players from the Negro Leagues, and they went with Jackie Robinson first because they knew that Jackie would be the best equipped to handle all the Jim Crow and everything that he'd face early on.
It's funny that you mentioned that, man, because I think that, this is just my personal opinion, that God picked the right one to go first. Because just think the first game that my father played, when he got called the N-word or got spit on, he went to the stands and hit the guy or attacked the guy. That might have taken the NBA back by 10 years. You never know.
Hmm.
So my father, he endured a hell of a whole lot, man, his first few years of playing basketball. He couldn't stay in hotels. Some cities he went to, he could stay in the hotel, but he couldn't leave the hotel room. So it was just rough. And every city he went to, just about, man, gave him the blues. Fort Wayne, Indiana, St. Louis, Baltimore, Philly, they gave my father the blues. But he took it in stride.
How?
It was so bad at some of the home games for my father that he wouldn't let my grandmother go to the games. Because he didn't want her to endure anything.
How does your father end up going into the NBA? Like, you know, where was he playing prior to this when they picked him?
You know, my father played the CIAA.
Okay.
And the CIAA was played in Washington, D.C. back then.
Okay.
I think it was called United Arena on U Street.
Okay.
And I guess some coaches or some scouts, somehow my father played, and they took a chance on him.
Hmm.
And let me just tell you this also. So when my father got drafted, nobody gave my father a chance in hell to make the team. Nobody. But my parents and the people in West Virginia. But he said when he got there, like I said, once he got to training camp, man, he was in the best shape of his life. And it was a level field at this time. And he said, back then what they do, in 1950, during practice, when you're trying to make a team, they had the search versus the skins.
Hmm.
And the search for the, you know, were the starters. They had spots. And the skins, where you go bareback, that you're trying to make the team. You say after the third day of practice, it was a wrap. They put him on the other side. So he knew right then and there that he had a spot after the third day. And what it was, these white guys never saw a guy so big, so quick, and just can play. My father was a beast, man. He was 6'8", around 240, 230. In 1950, that was unheard of.
Right.
And he can play. I mean, my father was a hard-nosed player, man, and defense and grabbing boards, the whole bit. He did all the dirty work.
How did he get along with his teammates?
Well, of course, in the court, you know, they were teammates.
Right.
But once the game ended, man, they had different lives. A lot of those guys back then, man, they drank. My father never drank or smoked anything like that, man. So if they had a game somewhere, out of town or wherever it be, after the game, you know, the white folks go their way and he went his way. So what he did, when they go out of town, he'd find out my father was heavy into jazz. And whatever city they was in, he would find a jazz club to go to after the game. And that's what he did. He'd just go to a jazz club by himself and just enjoy some jazz.
Were the coaches fair with him in regards to playing time and the way they treated him?
You had to be fair.
Okay.
Like I said, at that point, man, it's a level field. Why put the white boy off in there when you got somebody better than him that's going to crash the boards and play defense for you? Mm. Yeah, it was a wrap, man, after the third day. There's no, as far as the team is concerned, there's no racism. And it's all about, you know, the coach want to win. So you're going to put the best five players on the floor. And my father's one of the best five to put on the floor.
Now, you did talk about how your father, you know, experienced Jim Crow at the restaurants, at the hotels. Was it a lonely existence for him being, you know, the only black player on the team for so long?
I'm sure it was, but the way it was, the city that my father went to, he grew up Jim Crow.
Okay.
So what he was experiencing or what they were throwing at him, they were like, man, this ain't nothing. I've been doing this to me all my life. But what you're doing to me now is you got to come back. They used to try to break your spirit. Could you imagine, man, being a young 22-year-old, you go to a hotel, and the hotel manager tells you, listen here, nigga, you can stay here, but your black ass can't leave the room. And nothing you can do, nothing you can say, it's no problem. You go to your room till game time.
Hmm.
So could you imagine, man, you on the court, man, and somebody's spitting on you? Nothing you can do but wipe it off and keep playing. And my father used to say that when they start giving him the blues and start calling him the N-word, that means he's doing his job on the floor for sure.
That must have been tough for him, though. I mean, like, just emotionally having to keep all of that in.
I'm sure it was tough, but the way he grew up, man, he's been spending all his life.
Right. Hmm. Did your father, we call your father the Jackie Robinson of the NBA. Did he and Jackie ever meet?
I don't think they crossed paths.
Okay. Hmm. So how long did your father play professional basketball?
10 years.
Okay. So then...
And I don't know if you know, my father was the first black player in the NBA. He was also the first black assistant coach in the NBA. And he was also the first black bench coach in the NBA.
Hmm.
Bill Russell was the first black coach, but Bill Russell was a player coach.
Right.
My father was the first black bench coach in the NBA in 1971 with the Detroit Pistons.
Okay. And I know what that means, but can you just explain that for listeners, the difference between player coach versus a bench coach?
Well, it's just how you explain it. A player coach is the person who's a player slash coach.
Mm-hmm.
So Bill Russell was a player and a coach.
Okay.
But my father was the first black bench coach in the NBA.
Okay. Meaning that he's not a player. He's actually on the coaching staff.
He's the coach.
Right.
This is 1971.
And what team is this for?
Detroit Pistons.
The Pistons, okay.
But, you know, like any sport, that when my father got fired, I thought the owner was racist. So my father set me down and said, "Now, don't see it like that." You know, in sports, because football, basketball, baseball, it's all about W's. You don't win, they're going to fire you. Nothing in any sport. And it's 2020, that's the day. If you don't win, you're going to get fired. The only difference is that in today's sports, when you're black and you get fired, you might not get another chance. But the white guys, they get second, thirds, and fourth chances. And it is what it is.
Hmm. How long does your father coach?
He coached 2 years.
2 years, okay. Hmm. Since your dad was a trailblazer in so many different aspects of the game of basketball, was he also involved in the civil rights movement in terms of being involved in marches? And, okay.
Oh, yeah. For sure.
Did he talk about that also with you, like some of the marches or sit-ins or different things he may have done?
That's not really. But my father kind of person, he always took a stand, though.
Okay.
He always took a stand.
Did when he was still alive, did he get, in your opinion, did he get the proper respect and treatment from a lot of the black players who came into the league after him? Do they know about what he did?
Yes, a lot of them do, and a lot of them don't know.
Okay.
The ones that do know, they show them love.
Okay.
For sure. You know, the Dr. J's and Kareem and Bill Russell and Casey Jones, all the old heads, they know who my father is, and they know what he went through.
Okay.
So they always show them a lot of love. You know, these young guys make so much money nowadays, and they don't have a clue who paved the way for them, who kicked the door open for them, who got spit on, and couldn't get with the teammates.
Hmm. So your father was inducted into the Hall of Fame in what year?
2003. He went in there with the players were Robert Parrish and James Worthy.
Okay. Right, and this is the Basketball Hall of Fame. So...
Yeah, the Nation's Basketball Hall of Fame, correct.
Okay. Did you get to attend the ceremony?
Oh, absolutely. It was incredible. It was 3 days, man. It was just incredible.
Yeah. Well, was there one thing about that weekend that really stood out to you?
The whole weekend, I think what stood out, man, when he got his Hall of Fame ring.
Okay.
When he actually said, you are officially a member of the Nation's Basketball Hall of Fame, and they put that ring on his finger.
Okay.
And in his mind, you know, they took a small black kid from Alexandria, Virginia, to the Nation's Basketball Fame.
Mm-hmm.
Man, it's touching.
Yeah. How much money were players getting during your father's time period in terms of the salaries? Do you know?
I think, man, when my father first started playing in 1950, he was probably making, I'm guessing, around $3,000, $4,000 a year. And when he retired 10 years later, he was probably making maybe $20,000, $30,000 a year. Not much at all.
Right. Did the guys back then have to get other jobs beyond just playing basketball?
Absolutely. doing something. You got to subsidize. A lot of guys have families. You got to get a second job to subsidize.
So your father passed away in what year?
3 years ago, February. Do the math.
Okay. So if he was still...
He was 87 years old, so, man, he lived a good life. Okay. He lived a hell of a life.
When your dad...
My father's employed in some type of capacity, man. My father worked for the NBA for 65 years in some type of capacity.
Okay. So after he stopped coaching, then, what was he doing with the NBA?
He was a radio announcer for the Detroit Pistons. He was a TV announcer for the Detroit Pistons.
Hmm.
He was a executive with Dodge, the Dodge division.
Mm-hmm.
But he always had a decent job, for sure.
Hmm. So then he was around. So during the Bad Boys years with Isaiah Thomas, when they were winning those championships, what was your dad's role with the Pistons at that point? Do you remember?
He didn't have a role with the Pistons, but he loved the Bad Boys though.
Okay.
Now my father's a big guy, big rugby guy. So he liked Rick Mahorn. He liked Bill Laimbeer. He really liked him.
Hmm. Did your dad before he passed? Did he talk at all about just the current state of, I don't even want to just make it on the NBA, but did he just kind of talk about the current state of the black athlete, just in terms of what he thought about the black athlete today?
My father always just thought, man, in his heart, that he's a prime assumption for the kind of money the kids are making today.
Mm.
He's part of that.
Okay.
The money they make today. Because he's the one, like I said, he's the one that took it all from them to live the kind of life that they have. Like I said, he's the one that got spit on. He's the one that got called nigger.
Right.
He's the one that couldn't be in the hotel with his teammates. Man, he took it for them. So in a sense, all those every black kid comes to that door, past and present, man, they owe my father.
Yeah.
In a sense.
Yeah. When you have all of these athletes today making so much money, especially in the NBA, they have these really huge contracts now. And some of the guys, I mean, they get the money and then they do different things with that in the community. And then others spend it on, you know, a lot of cars and jewelry and houses and things like that. Did your father, how do you feel about that?
My father used to be kept every year.
Okay.
And he used to talk to the rookies to tell them how, you know, what he went through.
Okay.
And it's, man, I just got one advice for you with your money, because when it's all said and done, they don't owe you nothing.
Mm.
So you get it while you can.
Yeah.
And instead, and instead of having five cars, six cars, maybe you can get by with two cars.
Right. Right. Did he?
You know, watch how you spend your money.
Right. Right. Did he encourage them to give back at all as well with the money, to give back to the key and do something?
Just be involved in. Be involved in the community.
Right.
However you want to do it. I can't, you know, however you want to people be involved doing something. You got to get back in some kind of way. Even when my father was coaching, man, he always gave to the kids. If the kids are in the equation, man, my father will help too. He did a lot of speaking engagements. He always, you know, like talk to kids. Go to school. Get an education. Get a job. Do the right thing. Stay off drugs. My father said, well, if you talk to these kids, then you tell them, man, if you don't try drugs, you can't get hooked on drugs.
So, because of your father, we had Michael Jordan back in the 1990s. And with Mike, you know, Mike was he really took the athlete, especially the black athlete, to heights that we never saw. And one of the criticisms, though, about Mike was that, you know, he never really spoke up. During his playing days, he never really spoke up on social and political issues.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, we look at today's athlete, and you have a LeBron James in the NBA or a Colin Kaepernick in the NFL, guys who are very, very political and very vocal on, you know, social. Kaepernick, I mean, he may never play again because he's spoken up so much, right?
He took a hell of a stand. He knew the stand he was taking, what the consequences were.
Yeah. Do you think if your dad was alive, your dad would be more in the camp of the LeBrons, who are very outspoken and political, or would he?
He loved LeBron James, man.
Okay. Okay.
Everything LeBron does.
Did he ever talk about Michael though, and the fact that Michael was so quiet when it came to social issues?
No, he's not out loud. He didn't.
Do you think if your dad was alive now, he would agree with people not, the athletes not standing for the national anthem and that protest?
I think my father's name would be, it's called free speech.
Okay.
Free speech, man. But, so, you know, and Kaepernick had free speech, and, you know, whatever happens, he's paying for it. It's all good. He got, man, that's a good brother. And Nike just endorsed him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that.
With a commercial, so...
Ladies and gentlemen, this is UMES 30. You've been listening to excerpts from my conversation with Kevin Lloyd. Kevin is the son of Basketball Hall of Famer and Trailblazer Earl Lloyd. Earl Lloyd was the first black player in the NBA. He integrated the league. He was the Jackie Robinson of the NBA in professional basketball here in America. He was also the first black bench coach in the NBA, the National Basketball Association. I hope that you enjoyed excerpts from that conversation that we had.
In a stadium filled with whites, white fans, coaches, players, and announcers, they called this black man's name. With jazz in his stride, he broke through the color lines, broke through the cage of segregation. He stood in the eye of racism storm and took on the hate that he was facing. 1950, the turn of the century, a decade after the Great Depression, and this first step echoed throughout the world, the nation. Outside the arena, strange fruit would hang from trees. At certain times, you could smell death that was carried by the breeze. You were either living Jim Crow's nightmare or the great American dream. But through marches and sit-ins, equality was slowly being found in the streets and the Supreme Court. In the meantime, Earl played on despite being refused by hotels, restaurants, and other teams when they visited those sundown towns. His battle was fought on the court. Guided by strength and will, loved by many, his strength you could feel. That's why he was first, the NBA's first black player, the first black champ. He was first before Bill Russell, before Will Chamberlain, before Oscar Robertson, Dr. J, before Kareem and Magic, before Jordan, before Kobe, before LeBron, before Durant and Rose amazed millions with moves that they practice and rehearse. Chuck Cooper, Sweetwater Clifton, and Earl Lloyd were the first to be chosen. They paved the way for future hoop dreams to become a reality.
Their first steps. Mother always said one thing to me.
Became.
I mean, every time I left, she said to me, do not embarrass this family. And she was not talking about winning or losing. She didn't want me going out there acting like a damn fool somewhere. I mean, she didn't want anybody to think. They call it, in my day, they called it home training. I mean, you know, and if I go out and exhibit, I don't have home training, that's a poor reflection on them. No, they didn't play that. And when you love people, all you want to do is one thing. You want to please them. That's the way it was. And sure, lucky I was. I've been very blessed. And it's very easy to be successful when you're always surrounded by collectively. All the people have touched me, and there's a lot of handprints on me. You don't come from Ellisland, Virginia to Springfield, Massachusetts without some hands on you. You really don't. So collectively, I want to thank everyone who helped me along that journey. And what you really did, you took a question mark in Alexandria and made it an exclamation mark in Springfield. Thank you, and God bless you.
We end each show with a segment called Parting Shots. Here's when I give my thoughts on something happening in the news, pop culture, or life in general that's piqued my interest. The Academy Awards ceremony is airing on CBS on February the 24th. One of the favorites to win the Oscar for Best Picture this year is Green Book. The film tells the story of Dr. Don Shirley, a classically trained African-American pianist who became internationally known during the 1950s and the 1960s. In the summer of 1962, Dr. Shirley toured the Jim Crow South, along with his band and his Italian-American driver, Tony Vallelonga, also known as Tony Lip, to see if his music could combat racism. The film is named after the Negro Motorist Green Book, a guidebook for African-American travelers written by Victor Hugo Green to help them find motels and restaurants that would accept them. The book was a necessary resource for Black travelers between 1936 and 1966. While the movie does focus somewhat on the Green Book itself, it focuses a lot on the story of Dr. Shirley, as well as this friendship that he forms with his driver. If you have some free time this weekend, I strongly encourage you to try to go see this movie. And like I said, there's a good chance that this could end up winning the Oscar this year for Best Picture. And that's our show for the week. Thanks again to our guest, Kevin Lloyd. We do this every Sunday at 10:30 a.m. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. Like us on Facebook and social media. A special shout out, as always, to Uncle Phil and Aunt Viv. Have a blessed day.